argument on the merits.
Good morning, Councillor. Are you both ready to proceed? Yeah. Okay. And my understanding, Ms. Black, you want to have 7 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a yellow warning light come on when you have 7 minutes to go in your argument, and we will give you, Ms. Martin, a five-minute warning. Okay? Please proceed. Thank you. You may proceed. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Claire Wong Black, and I represent UNIDEV LLC and UNIDEV Hawaii LLC, petitioners, defendants, appellees in this matter. In 2001, the Hawaii legislature spoke. It adopted the Revised Uniform Arbitration Act, or the RUAA, which was a substantial departure from Hawaii's existing arbitration statute. The RUAA's legislative history noted that Hawaii's arbitration laws were, quote, outdated and did not adequately reflect current arbitration practices that had developed over the years. The legislature's stated purpose in adopting the RUAA was to standardize Hawaii's arbitration laws with those used in other states by codifying the Uniform Arbitration Act. The RUAA authorizes six grounds for appeals from arbitration-related orders. Nowhere does it authorize an appeal from an order compelling arbitration. The Intermediate Court of Appeals had no appellate jurisdiction over the Third Circuit Court's order compelling arbitration for two reasons. First, under Hawaii Revised Statute 1-24, this court must interpret the RUAA to achieve uniformity with other RUAA states. And the majority rule for those states that have adopted the RUAA is that orders compelling arbitration are not appealable. Second, the continued use of the collateral order doctrine to exercise appellate jurisdiction over orders compelling arbitration is contrary to the Hawaii RUAA. This court held in Chambers v. Levy that the right of appeal is purely statutory and exists only when given some constitutional or statutory provision. Here, neither of the statutory provisions allow appeals of orders compelling arbitration. First, the RUAA's appeals provision, Hawaii Revised Statute 658A-28, authorizes arbitration-related appeals in six circumstances, but does not specify orders compelling arbitration as one of them. The second statute, the General Appeals Statute, Hawaii Revised Statute 641-1, only allows appeals from final judgments and orders, not interlocutory orders such as those compelling arbitration. Here, the ICA found it had appellate jurisdiction pursuant to a judicially created exception to the General Appeals Statute. This exception, the collateral order doctrine, was first applied to allow appeals of orders denying and compelling arbitration in a 1985 Supreme Court case called Kukui Plaza v. Swinnerton. At the time Swinnerton was decided, the collateral order doctrine was an appropriate gap filler because the arbitration statute in existence at the time was silent regarding arbitrability of orders compelling and denying arbitration. But the RUAA explicitly closed that gap by authorizing appeals of orders that would frustrate arbitration. Conversely, the RUAA does not authorize appeals that would promote arbitration.
But is the RUAA permissive? Because it says in 658A28, an appeal may be taken. So the term may would seem to be permissive and not limiting. Do you have any response to that? So that the six items listed are not exclusive?
I would submit that it is not permissive. If you look at 658A28B, it says an appeal under this section shall be taken as from an order or judgment in a civil action. refers back to the six before it, and to promote the pro-arbitration policies as well. Numerous other RUAA states have held that orders compelling arbitration are not appealable specifically because of the exclusion in the statute.
Well, Swinnerton said it doesn't seem make much sense to force someone to arbitration and then later on determine that the case wasn't subject to determination. I'm sorry, arbitration. So the court said that in that particular instance, there should be judicial review of a order either granting or denying arbitration.
The issue in Swinnerton involved a denial of a motion to compel arbitration. And there, the court's concern was that the denial of arbitration was effectively a finding that the party had waived its right to arbitration. And that was the animating policy that led them to hold that orders denying motions to compel arbitration were appealable. And then in a sentence, some paragraph later, it says, by the same token, orders compelling arbitration are similarly appealable. And when the legislature adopted the RUAA in 2001, it made a choice to expedite proceedings where trial orders arbitration. It made a choice to put itself in a class of 16 jurisdictions at the forefront of arbitration.
Did the legislature say anything like, we know by adopting this provision, we're changing the current law, limiting the right to appeal arbitrations to compel? And did it say anything like that?
It did not, but the legislature is presumed to be aware of the court's holdings and interpretations of the law when it enacts amendments.
It's a pretty big change not to say anything about it, wouldn't you say? Yeah. In other words, it would mean that one would always have to go to arbitration and go through arbitration before you'd have the right to appeal the motion. It's a pretty sea change almost.
There are two issues. First, the legislature didn't explicitly address the appeals provision of the RUAA when it enacted the legislation. That's true. But the RUAA was a fairly significant change to Hawaii's existing statute. There were a number of provisions that were significantly modified, and so it did not explicitly point to 828 as something to discuss.
Are you familiar with the FAA?
Yes.
And I'm looking at the ICA decision on the motion to dismiss, and it cites the FAA, so I'm just assuming that this is the relevant provision. But it says, an appeal may not be taken from an interlocutory order. It says, granting a stay of any action. And two, directing arbitration to proceed under Section 4 of this title. So the FAA explicitly says, you cannot take an appeal or obtain judicial review of an order compelling arbitration.
Right.
But that kind of language is not present in the RUAA, is it?
That's correct. The FAA contains an express prohibition while the RUAA does not, and that is not just the Hawaii RUAA, that's the version, the 2000 amendment to the Uniform Arbitration Act that was promulgated by the National Council of Uniform Laws. The notes to the 2000 version of the RUAA, the national version, state that they had comprehensively updated the RUAA such that it would not be preempted by the FAA. So there is an intent that the provisions of the RUAA would track the FAA, although they did not include the express prohibition. And with respect to the public policy supporting no appeal of orders compelling arbitration, the rationale behind the rule that an order compelling arbitration shouldn't be appealable is that to permit an appeal would delay and defeat the purposes of the arbitration statute. And this case is a prime example of that. The complaints were filed in 2009 and 2010. The motion to compel arbitration was made in 2010, and then five sets of briefings were done.
What about a party who has a good argument, although one that doesn't prevail in the trial court's view, that they're not even a party to the agreement and therefore shouldn't be compelled to arbitrate? That party will have to go through an entire trial before they can have that interest vindicated, or is there some kind of safety valve or some kind of mechanism for a party to be able in some circumstances to have this kind of issue raised on appeal, or is that door absolutely closed in your view?
Two responses. Many of the RUAA courts say that if there is a challenge to arbitrability, that can be done upon confirmation of the award. And that squares with the RUAA's policy of favoring arbitration agreements and the goal of moving parties in an arbitrable dispute into and through arbitration as quickly as possible.
I guess the question is there some form of is there some safety valve that would allow in some circumstances a party to appeal as opposed to having to go through an entire trial?
The trial court has the discretion upon a party's motion to certify the order for interlocutory appeal under 641.1b. And so, you know, the trial court is in the trenches making the determination as to whether or not a dispute is arbitrable, and even given the presumption favoring arbitration, should they have any lingering doubts, they can always certify.
So you are conceding that 641 would apply. 641.1 would apply.
Yes, because it is a jurisdictional statute.
But you argue that the collateral order doctrine under 641 does not apply.
Yes, because the collateral order doctrine is a judicially created exception to the statute rather than a statutory allowance. And on top of that, the RUAA's enactment.
Following up on the Chief Justice's hypothesis, hypothetical situation, do you think that a non-party who was ordered into arbitration, for example, was not a signatory but perhaps ordered into arbitration by estoppel, could they file a declaratory judgment action?
It's possible. And even taking into account the concerns regarding ordering a party through arbitration where they may not be subject to it, in adopting the RUAA and expressing a strong pro-arbitration policy, the legislature made a policy decision about that. And here, we don't have that type of factual situation. Whether or not the county was a party to the ADSA or should arbitrate under the ADSA, the county and UNIDEF both signed the DSA. They're both parties to the DSA where they affirmatively elected arbitration as their preferred dispute resolution mechanism.
Assuming we conclude, if we were to conclude that the collateral order doctrine does apply and we have jurisdiction to decide whether or not the order compelling arbitration could be reviewed here, is it your position that under the ADA the entire dispute should be submitted to arbitration?
Yes. The claims in the complaint each either explicitly or implicitly reference the terms of the agreement or require reference to the agreement to understand the underlying claims. Yes.
Under what conditions should a judge, if we were to adopt your position, should a judge certify an arbitration order for appeal?
I think that would depend on the circumstances and how strongly the judge feels about the facts and how they come into play.
So it'd be based on a confidence rating of the judge's ruling? I mean, is that what you're suggesting?
It's in the trial court's discretion. That's correct. And I think under 641.1b or under 54b, there's no right to appeal. The trial court's denial of the certification as well. So yes,
Please speak up a little bit. I'm sorry.
I apologize. Yes, it's in the trial court's discretion. Turning back to uniformity.
So I just want to confirm. So you're saying that a trial court would have jurisdiction to allow an interlocutory appeal, even though your position is that 658A would indicate that there is no appeal from an order compelling arbitration?
I think that there are two jurisdictional statutes at play, the general appeal statute under Hawaii law, as well as the RUAA.
Okay.
If the judge had done that, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
If the judge had done that in this case, would you be arguing that the judge had abused his or her discretion in allowing the interlocutory? I mean, is that the kind of decisions that a court, and I'm not suggesting this case, but any case, aren't we creating a whole other realm of issues and factors? And
it is.
And the opposite way, somebody arguing that the judge abused his or her discretion, although it's non-appealable, I suppose.
The ability to certify an interlocutory order for review is somewhat different from an appeal as of right. And so I would submit that a review under 641B1B is more pro-arbitration than an appeal as of right under the collateral order doctrine, and that squares with Hawaii's legislative policy of favoring arbitration.
You didn't raise that theory on appeal or on cert, did you?
No.
You agree that with the ICA holding that the DSA applies to the county, I suppose? Okay. So in terms of the DSA applying to the county, the question would be the scope of the arbitration clause.
So I'm just going to have to ask you to speak up. I'm sorry. Sometimes I can't hear what you're saying. Thank you.
Yes.
So what's your position on the ICA's holding that the term, well, arising under the terms of the contract or the agreement, that limits the arbitrable issues to either interpretation of the contract or performance of the contract?
The language isn't limiting so much as it is defining. The RCA...
Confining, ICA, you said?
Defining.
Okay.
The RCA made a determination that arising under is narrow versus arising under and related to. And that was based on fairly old Second Circuit case law that's been rejected by the Second Circuit. The Ninth Circuit appears to be the holdout in following this. And so taking away the narrow versus broad, the claims arise under it. The analysis would be whether or not the claims arise under the terms of the agreement. And here, the claims do arise under the terms of the agreement. The claims involve construction or interpretation of the DSA and the ADSA's terms, and they require a determination of the party's rights or obligations under the terms of the DSA.
Including fraudulent inducement? There's a fraudulent inducement claim here. How would that involve a construction of the agreement?
The fraudulent inducement claim involves a number of different allegations, and many of them involve representations that were made during the time that the ADSA was in effect in 2008 regarding funding for the project. The fraudulent inducement claim is not limited to inducement to enter into the contract.
Is that part of the claim? Fraud in inducing to enter into the contract. Is that part of the claim?
Yes, it is.
That's you're saying that also goes through, in other words, in response to this Chief Justice's question, if it has to do with fraudulent inducement into the contract, the actual formation, under your view, that it's subject to arbitration?
I think that you would need to look at the misrepresentations or the allegedly fraudulent statements were, and compare it to the DSA's terms to determine whether or not the statements that are allegedly fraudulent actually led to the formation of the contract.
What about we are a company that is well capitalized with $50 million in assets, and there's no reference whatsoever in the contract to the assets of the company. Would that be arbitrable or not? During the course of negotiations, the company's president and CEO says to the county, we have $50 million in the bank. And because of that, the county enters into a contract, and then they find out that that company, in fact, didn't have $50 million in the bank. Does that arise under the contract?
I think it's unclear as to whether or not that would arise under the contract.
Who decides?
At the first instance, the trial court in determining arbitrability.
In any case, in this particular situation, the fraudulent inducement pertained not to the formation of a contract, but to funding provided by the county.
Is that correct? And there are specific provisions in the DSA.
So this occurred after the contract was formed?
Yes, that is correct.
So if you take issue with the ICA's position that there's just very limited scope of the arbitration clause here, what supports your position that it's broader than what the ICA held? What standard or tests are you relying on?
Even looking at the ICA's own language, this is at 289P4-1036, the court held that arbitration is required for claims that involve construction or interpretation of the DSA's terms or that require a determination of the party's rights and or obligations under the terms of the DSA. And that's essentially either looking at the contract language or looking at UNIDEV's performance or non-performance, alleged non-performance under the contract. And each of the complaint's claims directly relate to UNIDEV's performance under the contract. So, for example, this is Appendix I to the application for cert. It's the first complaint filed by the county. Paragraph 54, the county alleges that throughout the course of phases 1, 2, and 3, UNIDEV and or UNIDEV Hawaii provided performance to the county which purported to show the viability of the project. And this is, there are specific provisions in the DSA that outline what UNIDEV's performance obligations under phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 are. In addition, there's specific provisions in the DSA that outline UNIDEV's obligations with respect to performance. So that would be something that requires.
Are you advocating for any standard or test with respect to how you would interpret these words, arising under the terms of, arising here under, arising and or relating to the contract? What's your position? If you're saying the ICA was too narrow and should be broader, what's the test you're advocating?
Well, the majority of federal appellate courts hold that the phrases arising under and arising out of are broad, and they should be construed to encompass claims relating to the underlying agreements. A plain reading of the language supports that. Black's Law Dictionary defines arise as to originate, to stem from, to result from, to relate to.
Why is under the terms of the contract not limiting?
It's not limiting in the first instance in the determination of arbitrability, but it does define the scope. And here, all of the claims do relate to the terms of the agreement. Each of them require a reference to and some construction of either the DSA's language or an inquiry into UNIDEV's performance under the contract.
So you're saying that even if it's a tort claim, because you have to construe the contract in order to realize whether or not That's why it would arise under the terms.
That's correct, yes.
In terms of your argument regarding jurisdiction, so you're saying that this court does not have jurisdiction to review an order compelling arbitration. So therefore, would you then be asserting that a party against whom, if a party felt that the court abused its discretion in compelling arbitration, I see it wouldn't be an abuse of discretion. So the only only way to get here, mandamus would not be available.
It would be through at the confirmation of the arbitration award.
It would only be an appeal process after the confirmation.
That is correct. And that's to move the arbitration process and to expedite it to favor arbitration. Yes.
But your argument is that an interlocutory appeal order could be entered under the court's discretion under 641-1B, and therefore that would be reviewable under mandamus.
Yes, because that's a statutory provision rather than an exception to the rule. No more questions.
Thank you very much. Reserve the rest of your time, and we'll hear from Ms. Martin. Thank you. Thank you, Ms.
May it please the court. Good morning. Laurie Martin on behalf of the County of Hawaii, the plaintiff. The revised Uniform Arbitration Act does not provide a very good excuse or basis for this court to abandon decades of jurisprudence which have permitted an immediate appeal of an order compelling arbitration. Contrary to the assertion, there is no clear majority on this issue. Although 15 to 17 states have adopted the revised act, only 6 or 7 have addressed this issue. 3 states permit immediate appeals under the revised act: New Jersey, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. 3 or 4 states do not permit an appeal under the revised act: Utah, Oregon, North Carolina, and probably Nevada. The majority of the cases relied upon by UNIDEV do not address the revised Uniform Arbitration Act. Most of the cases relied upon were decided prior to the revised Uniform Arbitration Act being completed in the year 2000. Therefore, most of those cases are relying upon the Uniform Arbitration Act, which has a similar statute. The Uniform Arbitration Act, which
when you say it, the provisions are very similar with
very
regard
similar.
To.
Okay. But the point is, when you're comparing, you're saying these are the states with the revised Uniform Arbitration Act, and then you're trying to say, well, here's the majority. You really have to look at all of the states that have adopted the Uniform Arbitration Act, which apparently is 49 states, which I did not do. But the point is, with this similar language that the revised act has, there's this clear division of authority across the nation. There's a clear division based upon the language which is in our current statute.
Well, whether it's under the old statute or the new statute, some of the policy reasons that were set out in Swinnerton still apply, don't they?
Exactly. And
if you want to avoid litigation, it seems curious that you would require not allow appeal of order compelling arbitration, force the parties to go to trial. That doesn't avoid litigation, and then later on decide litigation was incorrect because the arbitration clause should not have been enforced.
Correct. And in this court concluded that back in 1985, concluded that an order compelling arbitration was part of that small class of orders which are collateral to the rights asserted in the action and which are too important to be denied review and too independent to require an appellate consideration to be deferred.
But the legislature could, the right to appeal is a matter of statute, so the legislature could, by adopting the RUAA, change that policy, correct?
That's correct. However, if you look at the previous statute under 658-15 and actually -12, which provided some appeal rights of some orders, it did not.
Arbitration orders.
Yes, exactly.
Not orders compelling or denying.
Exactly. Right. So those statutes permitted some appeals under arbitration decisions, but it did not authorize an appeal from an order compelling arbitration.
Or denying.
Right. Yeah. And it's very similar to, in that respect, as far as our order, very similar to the current statute, that it does not permit or it's silent as to whether orders compelling arbitration are appealable.
But in contrast to the prior statute, it is expressed, or it does provide for appeals of orders denying arbitration, correct?
Right, but it's silent.
Or denying a stay.
But it's silent as to whether you can appeal the order compelling. It doesn't say orders compelling arbitration cannot be appealed.
And your point of view or our contention is the legislature had to go the extra step and say that?
I think either say that or somehow amend 641, because under 641 you have all of this, you have decades of case law from this court and the ICA saying these orders are appealable. Even after 658A is enacted, you have all of these decisions, at least three by the ICA, which have said these orders continue to be appealable. This act, the revised act, was enacted or took effect in 2002. So clearly over the last 11 years, the legislature could have changed it, could have, as counsel has mentioned, the legislature is presumed to be aware of these decisions. But the legislature is not concerned about it. And that makes sense because this court has said the authority for these orders comes from 641.1. It doesn't come from 658A or 658. And I wanted to mention to the court, in 1992, the Excelsior Lodge case from this court said there is nothing doubtful in this jurisdiction about the appealability of orders to compel arbitration. And in that decision, this court required an immediate appeal if you are unhappy with an order compelling arbitration, and said that this court would not hear any appeals if you waited until a final judgment. It, subsequent to that, in Luke versus Gentry, this court in 2002 expressly referenced Chapter 658A, and dealt with an order which stayed the proceedings pending arbitration.
Would that allow you to gamble? If you were able to postpone an order to compel arbitration, you could actually go through arbitration, see what the result was, didn't like it, you go back to court for the court to approve it, then you decide to appeal it because you didn't like what happened there?
That's true. That's a possibility that a...
That's what Excelsior is talking about.
You know? You could wait and see how it turned out at arbitration. It's risky. I personally would want to do it, but it's risky. And even...
What do you make of the term may? Or do you make anything of it?
I believe that it's not required that we'd have to appeal it, but based upon that decision by this court in Excelsior, I would be concerned about trying to appeal something prior to a judgment.
What about the argument related to Hawaii Revised Statutes 1-24 that says we're supposed to interpret uniform laws to effectuate their general purpose to make uniform the laws of the states and territories that enact them? Now, your point of view is that it's kind of an even split as to how jurisdictions have gone, but if we go and look at the UAA and or find other cases that go in favor of saying not appealable, is there a point at which you would concede that we should give some weight to the fact that the majority of jurisdictions have gone the other way?
I think if it was a clear majority, you know, if you're talking about a small fraction of courts that are saying that type of order is appealable, but I don't believe that that's the situation.
What difference does it make if it's a majority one way or the other?
Just based upon that...
If you look at each of these cases, they construe not only the RUAA or the UAA, but they construe their general jurisdiction statutes also, or statutes or rules that apply with respect to appeals, didn't they?
That's correct.
So you would expect across the board that there would be some differences among the states with respect to their jurisdictional statutes.
That's true.
And so if we're looking not only at the RUAA or the UAA, but also our jurisdictional statute, you may very well come out differently from how other states may come.
That's true.
Out.
If you were strictly just looking at the revised act, but you're correct, you make the point that there's this other statute, the general jurisdiction statute 641.
Were you originally in favor of arbitration in this case?
Never. We never were in favor of arbitration.
Okay, but you're not challenging the court's decision with respect to the fact that there is judicial review of arbitration?
We didn't file an appeal on that. However, I do have some argument on that because I believe it really ties into why it's important that these orders are immediately appealable. We had a circuit court order that ordered us into arbitration based upon the ADSA, which we were never a party to. UNIDEP Hawaii apparently was ordered into arbitration. They're not a party to the agreement. Even under the DSA, and the county did sign the DSA. However, we signed it with the express understanding that it was going to be assigned. And it was assigned 4 months later.
UNIDEP itself resisted arbitration, didn't it?
UNIDEP initially did. Initially in the circuit court, Judge Strantz had asked, she had noticed the arbitration provision and had asked whether she was compelled to.
So all of these proceedings, they went on, you folks not sort of ignoring the arbitration clause and delaying the issue or the resolution of it even longer?
Well, the county, of course, we're not going to enforce the arbitration provision because we don't believe we're a party to either of the agreements. So, and in fact, that's what UNIDEP's position was when they filed the counterclaim.
So wouldn't it make more sense to be able to judicially appeal this issue promptly so that people don't waste time and money, or the judiciary doesn't waste time and money?
Yes, and I believe that the court's decisions, which talk about the importance of having that kind of resolution on an important, independent issue, are appropriate, and that's why we had initially appealed that decision.
Why not under an interlocutory appeal? Why doesn't that provide the means to address some very an unusual circumstance where, for example, a non-party is ordered to arbitrate, as opposed to allowing appeal of right in every case, which would seem to undercut the policy in favor of arbitration?
I think the major problem with saying such as a 54B certification is that you're leaving it to the discretion of the trial court. And so the trial court has already ruled a certain way. Somebody's unhappy and says, I want to appeal right now. You're wrong. And the trial court might not want that for whatever reason. The trial court might say, you know, no, I wanted to move forward. I don't see how I could possibly have been wrong on this issue. There may be other issues that the trial court wants. It's just not an adequate remedy.
But on the flip side, allowing an appeal of right in every case allows a party who's unhappy or wants to delay resolution of the dispute to take an appeal and, in essence, frustrate the intention of the parties in agreeing to arbitration if the appeal takes some time to resolve.
And I understand you always see the appeals that come from these things, but I'm sure that there are a lot of other cases where you don't have that type of appeal. And certainly in a case here where the county was required to arbitrate claims under an agreement they never signed, it's very understandable and appropriate. That's clearly going to be the fastest way to have that matter resolved.
But then if you go interlocutory appeal, one, that's inconsistent with saying that this statute prohibits judicial review of an order compelling arbitration. Is that right?
Yeah, I did not ask for 50.
And if so, also it would be sort of a hit or miss issue, right? And we'd be still faced with the same policy objection made in Swinnerton by the Hawaii Supreme Court. We don't have a explicit language like the federal government does, which makes me a little nervous about going along with federal statutes down the line or federal decisions down the line, because they have a statutory language that expressly prohibits judicial review of orders compelling arbitration, whereas we don't have. If the statute in this case is silent, as you say, and in other states they are, I guess, silent also, then that means that there can be that at least half of the states you cited, they don't read that statute as requiring or not requiring judicial review or prohibiting judicial review of orders compelling arbitration.
That's correct. And I would like to point out, even under the FAA, they do permit some appeals of an order compelling. So they haven't barred that completely, despite that language.
In terms of the scope of the arbitration clause, why isn't it that all the claims, as the circuit court held, should be covered?
The claims made by the county, such as the fraudulent inducement, clearly aren't looking towards the performance of the contract. We're saying these certain representations were made to the county to be awarded the project, to gain funds. It doesn't hinge on the terms of the contract or the DSA, such as a breach of contract claim.
Are you familiar with the Goldberg case? I think it was. I'm not sure. But the Goldberg case gave a broad reading to the same language, I think, arising under the terms of this agreement, as gave a broad reading, whereas the ICA gave a narrow reading to the same language. Do you have any response to that?
I don't have that case off the top of my head, but I would like to point out that in this particular agreement, in the DSA, where it says arising under the terms of this agreement, it doesn't say arising or relating to. And if you look at the non-recourse provision, and I believe I attached that to the county's response to the application for the writ, the non-recourse provision, which is on the same page as the DSA, is much broader. It says arising under or related to this agreement. It doesn't even say under these terms, the terms of the agreement. So it's much broader and it's on the same page. And so there's a clear intent, you can see the clear intent to make that arbitration provision narrower than the other provision.
Well, there are two different types of issues, right? Arbitration versus the recourse provision.
Yeah. Two different issues, but the language is strikingly different and on the same page. And everybody, of course, is represented by attorneys.
And so we would have to look at the cases going to recourse provisions.
Well, I think the language in general, when you have language that says arising under, you know, this agreement, or arising under the terms of this agreement, clearly that's narrower than arising under or related to. It's not a jump to say or relating to makes it broader. It's clearly broader.
Well, arising under the terms of this agreement, how is that different from arising under this agreement?
I think because of the words, the terms of this agreement, it makes it even narrower. So perhaps you could say, well, there's a little bit of wiggle room. You know, does this arise under the agreement in general?
Did you in your briefs identify specifically which and why these different claims fall under terms of agreement?
Well, our argument was that it did not fall under the terms of.
So you didn't go down each claim and say, okay, based on specific allegations in the complaint or whatever, these fall under.
I believe the brief to the ICA did go through the different claims. That was my memory. I apologize if I'm incorrect.
No, you didn't raise it on CERP.
I know I made an argument. Unfortunately, the page limit is so short for that I did make the argument that arising under was narrow, and I cited to some of the cases on that point. This whole issue with the Revised Uniform Arbitration Act had not been raised previously, so I was trying to address that.
The court issued a stay of the proceedings before the second complaint was filed. Does that make any difference with respect to an evaluation of the claims under, with respect to the scope of the arbitration clause?
I believe the complaint was filed before the her decision came down.
Sorry, didn't the stay occur before the second complaint was filed?
I don't believe so.
You don't believe so?
No, I don't believe so.
If it did, then what's the effect? Was an answer ever filed to the second complaint?
We consolidated it, yes.
No. Was an answer ever filed to the second complaint?
I don't believe so. I believe that...
Wasn't it not filed because the court ordered a stay before the second complaint was filed?
No. We entered into a stipulation to consolidate and stay.
You consolidated the cases, right? I'm not sure what that means, but... There was no answer to the second complaint at that point.
I think you're correct on that.
So what's the status of this case? Why wasn't an amended complaint allowed to be filed?
It's not that it wasn't allowed. What happened was I was running up against the statute of limitations, or the potential statute of limitations. So I filed a motion to amend, and the court had taken it under advisement, and she had not issued a ruling. And so when it came within days of the statute of limitations, I just went ahead and filed the amended complaint.
So if the court filed the stay before the second complaint was filed, did the court then decide or have before it the claims in the second complaint?
I don't believe she considered the claims in that second complaint. However, I think the stipulation that the parties entered into, we had agreed that her order would apply to that.
You had no stipulation that the answer and counterclaim would apply to the second complaint, though, did you?
I'm sorry?
You did not have any stipulation that the answer and counterclaim to the first complaint would also apply to the second complaint?
No.
So what we have are two complaints, an answer and a counterclaim to one of the complaints, and the court not deciding the claims on the second complaint in its decision on the arbitration?
That's correct.
And up on appeal, how was that treated?
I think we treated it as part of, because the court's order was so broad when she put everything into arbitration, that the parties acknowledged that if the court had the second complaint in front of her, she would put that into arbitration as well.
Did the ICA decide the claims in the second complaint?
I don't know if they specifically addressed it, although they did go through some of the claims, such as the fraudulent inducement. If I could just... And this goes back to whether the county is bound by the DSA. The DSA, which was signed by UNIDEV, states, whereas upon formation of the SPE, which is WWH, the sponsor shall assign all of its rights and obligations in and under this agreement to the SPE. Therefore, the parties expressly agreed that all of the rights and the obligations would be assigned to WWH. And just a few months after that, this is when the assignment and assumption agreement was executed. And the assignment provided WWH not only accepted all rights, but assumes and agrees to perform all of the terms, covenants, and conditions of the DSA. And UNIDEV has repeatedly acknowledged that the assignment was entered into with its consent. This is not surprising given that they signed the DSA that said exactly that. UNIDEV has signed a declaration stating that it consented to the assignment, and it's also answered an admission to that effect. What they seem to be arguing is that even though they consented to...
Are you saying that you're not bound by the ADSA?
We're definitely not bound by the ADSA. We didn't sign it. But the DSA, we're not
bound.
But
the ICA held that you're not bound by the ADSA, didn't it?
Right.
So what's the issue?
There's two agreements, and so the ICA found that the county was not bound by the ADSA, but the ICA found we were bound by the DSA, the prior agreement.
And so your position here is you're not bound by the DSA?
No, because it was assigned with the consent of UNIDEV, and it assigned all of those obligations.
UNIDEV did not sign off on the assignment, correct?
No, they didn't, but they signed off on the DSA, which called for that, called for the assignment of all.
And did the DSA say that upon assignment, the county will be relieved of any of its duties under this agreement, which would be required under a novation?
No, it doesn't say that, but it says that WWH is taking over all those obligations, and they're consenting to it. That's exactly, just because they don't use those magic words that the county is going to no longer be responsible, that's the effect of those words, is that WWH is assuming all of those obligations, and UNIDEV is consenting to that. Just because we don't use the word discharge or substituted, it doesn't change the meaning of those words.
That's what the ICA held, that you were not discharged. The county was not discharged.
And exactly.
Discharge was required.
That's correct. That is what they held.
Were you supposed to take a cross appeal from that, or file a cross writ on that issue?
I think we could have. However, based upon case law, once this court decides to hear this appeal, they certainly have the discretion to address any issues within the ICA's decision.
How are we supposed to know that you're challenging that?
I guess because I'm arguing it now. And we raised it below. See, my time's up.
No, oh, yep. You have a couple more minutes if you would. I mean, I think, how much more time does she have? 4 minutes.
I was going to reserve a little bit of time.
No, we sort of go one side, the other, and then rebuttal. So this is your shot.
Okay.
If you have anything else to say,
all right,
go ahead and say it. And if you don't, you can stand down, whichever you prefer.
I just want to, I think the issue of the scope is pretty muddled in this record, and the scope of the arbitration clause. So UNIDEV, in some of its cases, actually relies on a broader standard, you know, whether or not the dispute is touched by the terms of the contract or has its genesis or roots in the contract. What would your position be with respect to applying that as the standard as on coverage under the arbitration provision?
Obviously, the county feels that is too broad.
Would there be sort of insurmountable barriers to finally deciding this case if we said, okay, this claim goes to court, this claim goes to arbitration, and they're based on the same facts, essentially? Could you come out with conflicting rationales or conflicting results?
I think that's possible. However, I think part of the issue is, what did the parties agree to? What was the intent of the parties?
And it certainly could not have been the intent of the parties to separate claims out, would it? It says any dispute arising under the terms of this contract. Wouldn't that indicate the contemplation that anything arising under this contract or any dispute, you could read terms as being limiting, but you could also read it as simply saying, well, everything under the contract mentioned in the contract.
I think that because it does say arising under the terms of this contract, that we're bound by that, whether we think the result may end up being that the fraudulent inducement claim is subject to arbitration or not. Really, and maybe it'll get messy or maybe it'll take a little bit longer, is not really the issue. The issue is, what do the parties agree in this particular case? And it says arising under the terms of this agreement. Clearly, and when I read that, I see that as a breach of contract claim. You're suing because somebody breached the terms of this agreement. You're not suing because, well, you lied.
Yeah, you could have said just breach. Any dispute arising because of a breach of this agreement.
You could.
So under the terms of this agreement would be broader than that, wouldn't it?
I'm not sure. I really don't think that it would be. I think
any dispute would not be limited just to breaches.
I think it comes pretty close with the rising under the terms of this agreement. It's hard to imagine what other claims there could be that would arise under the terms of the agreement. other than a breach of contract claim. It could be possible, but it's hard for me to imagine what other claims would fall under that. And with this, the negotiation of the DSA, I mean, all these sides are represented by attorneys. And in fact, Mr. Cruzan, the principal of UNIDEF, is an attorney. They're all very well educated onto the terms and what they mean and the legal significance. And so, for whatever reason, they chose this particular language. And it should not be interpreted overly broadly just to get an end result, throw everything into arbitration because it'll be faster. It would be faster. It would be simpler, but it wouldn't be just.
You're familiar with the proposition, though, that if there's any doubt, then you decide in terms of arbitration.
I believe that's the case, though, yes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll hear a rebuttal from Ms. Black. How much time does she have? 4 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to address Justice Akova's two concerns first. The first regarding whether or not the ICA's decision relates to the second complaint. It appears yes. At 289 P3rd 1036, the ICA references the second complaint and says that none of the allegations involve interpreting or construing the terms of the DSA. Second, with respect to a standard, in Goldberg v. Focus Affiliates, which is a Northern District of Illinois case cited in the cert application, the court held that you look to whether or not the facts alleged in the complaint fall within the scope of the particular arbitration clause in question. So it's an analysis of the actual arbitration clause without relying on the distinction as to whether or not arising out of or arising under is unduly narrowing. With respect to the RUAA, there is a clear majority. There are three states that do not allow orders compelling arbitration. As Ms. Martin stated, they're New Jersey, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. With respect to New Jersey, the New Jersey Supreme Court, under its rulemaking authority, amended the statute to include orders compelling arbitration. I think that's in the case called GMAC v. Patella. Here, under Hawaii Revised Statute 602-11, this Supreme Court does not have that constitutional rulemaking authority.
Are you suggesting that the Constitution does not give the Supreme Court limiting authority? The Hawaii Constitution?
No. 602.
And since those states are going the other direction, it's pretty hard for us to really comply with 1-24 because we're supposed to make uniform. The laws are already not uniform, so how can we?
Well, there are 10 states that do allow orders compelling arbitration.
And are they RUAA states? Because that was her point, that some of them are not.
There are 10 RUAA states that do not allow appeals of orders compelling arbitration. And although some of those decisions predate the 2000 RUAA statute, the appeals provision between the UAA and the RUAA, they're not similar, they're identical. So the case law construing the UAA, other states' UAA appeals provisions are applicable to their RUAA provisions.
And what's the state of the law with regard to the UAA? In other words, you've got a category of states that are RUAA states that had decisions some before and some after the adoption. If we were just to look at the UAA, which I think we heard there might be 49 states, is that an issue you've looked at?
It's 49 states. New York has never signed on to either the UAA or the RUAA, and then the District of Columbia has adopted the RUAA. I would direct the court to an American Law Report. It's 6 ALR 462, and it lays out the state of the law somewhat. It would appear it addresses 41 of the states, both UAA and RUAA. And it looks like there are 6 or 7 UAA states that allow orders compelling arbitration for various reasons.
some involving their general appeals statute, and some just plainly on the basis of the language of the statute.
I'm sorry, does the UAA have an appeal clause?
Yes, it does, and it's identical to the RUAA's appeals provision.
Did we have that in our UAA?
No, we did not.
We did not.
Our UAA was very, very different from the 1956 national UAA. The appeals provision in our UAA was Hawaii Revised Statute 658.15.
So there are 6 to 7 states that have, under the UAA, that has the same language as the RUAA, did allow or do allow.
Yes.
Appeals of orders compelling arbitration.
Yes, but the vast majority of even the UAA states do not allow it. The District of Columbia is, I think, instructive because under its prior case law, orders compelling arbitration were held not appealable because the statute did not explicitly allow it. What the District of Columbia did was it amended its statute to include orders compelling arbitration as appealable.
Do you know if they had similar case laws, our jurisdiction?
A collateral order doctrine type?
Yes.
Exception? I don't believe so, but I'm not certain.
We've never adopted the UAA or the comments or notes to the UAA?
No. Our prior arbitration statute was not, it didn't relate to the UAA.
And not under the RUAA either, right?
The legislative history indicates that it adopted the RUAA, although it doesn't explicitly adopt the comments.
Okay. Are there any further questions?
Perhaps this is going too far, but I don't think I saw it in the briefs. I don't know. Did you brief whether or not whether attorney's fees would be allowable to compel, through the appellate process, to compel arbitration?
No, that wasn't brief.
Okay, thank you.
And I would just note that we made the ratification argument in both the ICA briefs below and in this writ that the county ratified the ADSA by suing under it, and so that the ADSA should apply to the county.
But you don't need the ADSA, right? If the ADA is in effect against the county.
I'm sorry?
If the county is still bound by the ADA, there was no novation. If this court were to find that there was no novation, then you would argue that arbitration is compelled under the ADA.
Arbitration is compelled under the DSA, the development.
The DSA.
That's correct.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Not the amended DSA.
Right. And our position is that the county ratified the amended DSA by suing under it, and it should be bound by that as well. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Council will take this matter under advisement. Thanks for your arguments today.